coming up on this episode of Inside Pop.
We are speaking to a director who's going to give us the inside scoop on what it's like directing some of TV's most popular episodes, including American Horror Story and Mayans.
Plus, Sean gives his rating and review of the band Karangbin in this week's Big Sell.
And we are going to give you the inside scoop on how to join the coolest club that's not exclusive, but that's very special.
It's all happening right now on Inside Pop. Hey, y'all. My name's Amita Patel.
And I'm Sean David Johnson, and this is Inside Pop, your deep dive inside the world of pop culture. We have a really special episode for you this week. Not only are we talking about the Maximum Fun Drive and we have our usual Big Sell segment, we have an incredibly special interview with a wonderful director who's created some of the content that I'm sure many of you have enjoyed.
We are so happy to have Rachel Goldberg join us on the podcast. Rachel is an award-winning director who has worked on American Horror Story Cult and Mayans MC on FX and the upcoming Netflix series Raising Dion and more. She's also a screenwriter who has been supported by the WIF Sundance Financing Initiative, the Film Independent Screenwriting Lab, and so much more. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. It's great to meet you guys.
Great to meet you, too. We're excited to speak to you about your work as a director in television and film. And I think we want to start off by asking you, it's so interesting just hearing Amita's introduction and just in the few TV episodes she mentioned, there seems to be such a diversity in the types of shows that you've directed. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that you face when you come into a series where there's so much established already, a visual style, tone, characters? How do you as a director adapt to this new world that you're supposed to continue to visualize and display?
That is an excellent question. Well, I feel very lucky, actually, that I've gotten to do such diverse work. That's pretty exciting to me because then I get to try all of these different things. For me personally, I study the show. So for AHS, even though it's an anthology series and it's different every season, I studied all seven seasons. And then the episodes that really popped to me, I sort of studied, you know, the choices that the director made. And then I shadowed on AHS the season before I directed. And then I went and I shadowed the episode before mine as well so that I can get a sense of the language in person, get to meet the cast and crew. And then because I'm very type A, I break down the episodes before mine, how I would direct them, how I'd cover them. And then I watch the dailies and see how the other director did it or the directors if it's multiple episodes before mine. So I really study the show. That way, by the time I get in there, I have a grasp on how things are moving. And then the challenge is always like, okay, now you've got a handle on the show. How do you make it your own? How do you add your own creativity? How do you add your own voice? But that's also the joy and the fun of it. So I feel very, very lucky. Because like you said, they're super different, not only tonally, but the way that they're shot. And getting to play in all of those different forms is so much fun.
That's so interesting. I love the idea that you get to shadow. Is that common to be able to have that opportunity on the episodes preceding what you would be directing?
Yeah. So, you know, AHS was my first episode of TV. And so typically it's difficult to break into television. But I think we had mentioned before we started recording, I've noticed a really big shift in the number of women getting to direct in television in the past couple of years. Like I'd say probably in the past 2 or 3 years, me and 15 of my friends have finally broken in, which is amazing after many, many years of hustling. And part of the way that you do that is by shadowing. So doing programs or fellowships or reaching out to your network, it's really, really hard for someone to give you a chance if you haven't actually put in a lot of time shadowing. Because even if you're a director and you've done a ton of films, TV is a different beast, and each show does have its own language. And then because AHS was my first show, of course they wanted me to shadow. Mayans was my second. Of course they wanted me to shadow. Raising Dion, they didn't ask me to shadow, but I did go when I was there prepping and visit set for a day or two before I started shooting. So I try to do that as a matter of course during my prep. I'm not an official shadow anymore, but I definitely go and spend some time so that I can meet everybody, make friends, and get a feel for the set.
That's great, because when I, as a director, you become the captain of the set, the leader of the set. I think also in terms of working with actors, I would imagine, need to establish full trust with them, right? You know, they're putting their performances in your hands. What's the experience like in terms of trying to form a very quick rapport with actors who you may have never worked with, and now all of a sudden you're on a set giving them direction?
I mean, you're right. Getting their trust is really, it's so important. And with all of the crew, like the cast and the crew, but specifically the cast, because they're making themselves so vulnerable. I try to meet them ahead of time, even if it's just for 5 minutes, to introduce myself and let them know that I'm going to be the upcoming director. So at least the day of, I'm not this like face out of nowhere that's terrifying. And then, you know, fortunately, the cast is used to it. They're used to having a different director every episode or every two episodes. But I try to gain their trust by just being there for them, by watching their performance, by giving them feedback. I love working with actors, and I have a background in theater. And so I sort of pride myself in being able to work well with actors. It's one of my favorite parts. And I think typically I found that some directors are really terrified of the actors. And on some sets I've been on, they're just so excited that I talk to them that helps win their trust. But you can't just talk to them and say nothing. You have to be smart, and you have to be really paying attention to the performance, so that the notes you give, then they know that you've got their back. But it takes time. It's hard. For some actors will give you their trust instantly, and some actors it will take the whole shoot, and maybe you'll gain their trust by the end. Or not. You might never gain their trust.
It's a delicate balance of everything that you have to manage just going into doing one episode of a series, right? Like just with the relationships with the actors, but also with the crew. And, you know, like Sean said, you have to be the captain and lead, but you also need to build relationships in a short period of time, which is so, I never thought of it like that when it comes to, you know, directors in episodic, because they do change directors every episode, almost, you know. Sometimes they'll keep the same throughout, but like they do change it often. So that must be such an interesting dynamic to always like to really level, like to set your expectations for every single time.
You're always the new kid, always. Yeah. So it's like you have, and specifically as the director, you are the new kid, because the cast is there week to week. The crew is there week to week. So you really are like the odd man out or woman out every episode. So yeah, it's tricky. It can be really glorious, and it can be really fun. It can also be terrifying.
I'm sure it builds quite a big amount of character and also a lot of adaptability on your part.
Yeah. No, it's really fun. I also teach, and I think that like that has helped me have the skill of being the new kid, because it's like every semester it's a whole new group of kids that I have to try to win over really quickly.
Right.
So I feel like that's helped, like the odd, bizarre, twisty, turny background, I think, has helped.
Yes, definitely. And you had mentioned, you know, earlier in your answer that, you know, you've been seeing a shift in Hollywood, in the studios, about hiring female directors. Is that shift connected to bigger players like Hulu and Netflix and Amazon just increasing the amount of scripted episodic TV that's happening right now? Or is it just the conversation has come to the forefront and people are actually answering the challenge?
I think it's both and more. I think part of it is that there is a lot more content. I mean, last year, I think there were 500 episodes of television. And yeah, if you go back 5 years ago, it was nowhere near there. So there is way more opportunity, which definitely means they can't keep hiring the same people. Like there's too much work, which is great. And then part of it too is that the conversation has been getting louder and louder and louder. I mean, we've been having this conversation for years. Like as women directors, we have been talking a lot. But I do think there's more awareness with the whole Me Too issue. And I think just in general, and people calling other, like, you know, big profile actors, like calling people out about hiring female directors. I think that has helped a lot. But it's also success. You know, you take a look at like some of the like big television shows or films that have been helmed by women or by minority directors, and they've had huge success. That helps. And then I think it's the biggest change, in my personal opinion, is people that are in a position of power taking a risk and showing that it works. So like Ryan gave me a shot. Ryan gave a lot of people their first shot. And Ryan's a powerhouse. I mean, AHS is a big, big show. Like it's like Emmy winning. I had Lena Dunham in my episode. It's a multi-million dollar. And like that was my first episode. And he was like, I trust you. Here you go. And wow. Knock on wood, they were happy with what I did. And they've done that for multiple people. And it's someone like Ryan saying, okay, I'm going to give you a shot. And it worked. That makes other people less scared. Ava did it on Queen Sugar. You know, like there's a lot of shows that like these people with power are like, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to try to actually initiate change. So I think it's the combo of all of those things that has finally allowed something to happen.
Yeah. Well, and thank God for that. Right.
Yes.
It's a nice and wonderful storm of two actions coming together. And you are the product of that, which is amazing.
I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful. And I'm very lucky. Like, despite there being more opportunities, it's still really hard. You know, I know that I'm one of the very few and lucky who was able to break through to the other side. But I'm just excited that I'm seeing it happen more and more. Like, I just feel like if we can all keep growing and if we can all just keep bringing up our sisters and our brothers and like just keep this momentum alive, that we'll start to see some really massive change, which is exciting.
It is exciting. I mean, I think we'd all agree, long overdue. It's exciting that it's happening now and that what you're relating to us is it's tangible. You're in Hollywood. You're seeing friends getting more opportunities and succeeding. One thing I'd be really interested to ask you in terms of that kind of day-to-day experience. So basically in terms of how people, you know, on the crew, like, you know, gaffers who've been in the union for 20 years and now they're, you know, they're answering to a female director. Are you know, in terms of just kind of your everyday working with crew, how do you see people responding to people in the industry responding to the increase in female directors and women calling the shots in different ways that they haven't had the chance to do before?
I think it's different on every set, but I would say 90% of the time it's been really, really positive.
Great.
It's not always. Those things will remain unnamed. but 90% of the time, absolutely. You know, and even on the sets where there might be one or two people who give you crap, there's still a gazillion women who come up to you and are like, we're so excited to have a female director. There's still actors that are like, we're so excited that you're here. Like, we love what you're doing. Like, there's always been people who are incredibly supportive of my being there, which is really, really nice because it is hard. And, you know, you are the odd man out and you will face stuff that sucks. But that also goes, I feel like, as a director, it's hard. Everything's your fault, even when it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just part of the game. So whether some of that comes from your gender or not, I don't know if that makes it. I mean, on the situations where it sucks, it really sucks when it deals with your gender. But there's so many obstacles that you deal with anyway. It's all just part of the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now that we've just talked about all of the opportunities you've been able to get, is there a bucket list or a dream or just like something that exists right now? Like, you know, Game of Thrones is already done shooting, but like I would have loved to do a Game of Thrones or something that's coming up that you're like, I really want to get a shot at that.
I would have loved to have done Legion. I did not get Legion, sadly, but I would have loved to have get Legion. I mean, it's just so bizarre and wonderful and visual. Yes, Game of Thrones would have been amazing. That goes without saying. I love Fargo. Fargo would be awesome. Sinner is a great show. I really like Sinner. Like, there's so much. There's so much great content right now. So for me, like, when I sort of define what I'm drawn to, it's like three categories. It has to be character driven. The characters have to be really three dimensional. I have to care about them. But I also need it to be really visual. If it's not visual, it's super hard for me to get excited about it. And then I need it to say something, like to have some meaning. Like there's something underneath of it. There's a message. Like AHS, it's big and it's in your face and it's crazy. But like my episode was about toppling the patriarchy. It was awesome. So like I've been fortunate in that everything that I've worked on to date is really trying to say something. Like Raising Peon is so special, you know, like just having the 7-year-old black superhero, like, and that his single mom is the real hero, like she's the superhero, is so powerful and so important, and we need it. And Mayans, like, you know, dealing with issues of immigration and just having like an entire cast that's brown, like it's political just by being. So that's that's so important to me. That's like just in my work as an artist as general, it has to say something, or it's hard for me to get behind it. So if it fits one of those, and hopefully all three, I'm a happy camper.
One thing that all of these seem to have in common as well, and maybe that ties into the visual aspect, but they all feel really cinematic to me, right, in some ways. And I think TV feels more, quote-unquote, cinematic now than it did, say, 15 years ago. So I'd love to ask you to talk a little bit about how your film work perhaps influenced your work on TV, and if there are any specific examples of how, you know, you were able to kind of draw on your work as a film director to solve problems or come up with an interesting shot or scene for one of your TV episodes.
You know, it's such an interesting question, and no one has really asked me that before. And what's interesting is that I think I've gotten to be way more cinematic in television than I was able to be in the indie film world, because I didn't have the money in the indie film world to do the things that I'm doing in television. I didn't have cranes when I was making my indies. What? I didn't have Steadicams. What? But I do think what the indie world sort of prepped me for in a number of ways was being able to shoot really fast and to be really efficient. Because when you don't have money and you're trying to shoot, you know, 30 minutes in 3 days, you got to hustle, but you still need your story to be clear. So I actually think my television work is a lot more visual and a lot closer to the work that I want to be creating visually than I was ever able to do in my indie films, just because I didn't have the money to do it. I'm still proud of them. I'm still proud of what they looked like, but we just didn't have the money, even for like the funky lenses, like forget like the other stuff. But I do also, like, ironically, I think my theater background is what helps me to be more visual. Because coming up in theater, my work was very spectacle-based. It was very big. It was very experimental. And I actually had a friend who was like, you should look into film because your work is so visual. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. But I'm used to, like, seeing big, and I'm used to, like, creating big from my world of theater. I just wasn't always able to do it in my indie film work.
That's interesting. I think about, like, just you saying that, I think about, like, Julie Taymor, who is a theater director, and then, like, every, like, you know, no matter what you think of her films, they're always beautiful and always so visual. And then I also think about Tom Ford, this, you know, this fashion designer who made, like, this incredibly beautiful, amazing film. So I love that when people transition from something that isn't necessarily a direct translation, but it works. I love that. I love when it works. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I do think, you know, because in the film world, you primarily work single camera, and in television, you don't. You're usually, at least my experience has been, you're using at least two cameras, if not three. I do think that single camera background helps my work to be more visual and a little bit more cinematic, because I'm thinking, you know, that single camera stuff is all specials in television, you know, where you're getting a shot, but if you try to get that shot, you can't fit another camera in, but that's what makes it feel cinematic. And I do think, because I think single camera, and then I have to figure, and that was a big learning lesson for me. And Brad Beaker, who's the producing director on AHS, really, really helped me tremendously to figure out how do you take these 9 different specials and turn them into like 3 setups that you can do with multi-camera. And so that's been really beneficial as I work in television to help hopefully make it a little bit more cinematic. But it's already cinematic. That's what's cool. Like, TV really has grown. Like, the work that you see on television is so, it really is. It's film. It's so filmic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pleasure to sit on my couch and watch these TV shows because it's so beautiful. People talk about Handmaid's Tale and they're like, it's so dark and it's so depressing. And I was like, but it's gorgeous. Look at it.
It is gorgeous and powerful and hard, but good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, as we said, you've written and directed, you're a screenwriter as well. You've directed some short films. So you wear multiple hats. You also produce as well when you do your short films as well. So, you know, is there one you prefer, writer, producer, director, theater also? Is there one you prefer over the others?
I mean, I bill myself as a director first. I love to write. I absolutely love to write. I do not love to produce. Like, producing is just because you have to.
Hey, hey,
Hey. I mean, for me. I don't mean that for the born producers out there. I mean, when I've produced, it's because I've had to.
Got it.
Because there's no one else who's going to do it. But producing is fun too, but I really, to me, I just love directing and I do love writing, but if I had to choose, I'd absolutely choose directing. And whether it's for theater or film, they're both beautiful. Like theater brings me so much joy because I really do love working with actors and you get to immerse yourself for weeks in the same story and just like play with your actors. Like so much of your focus is in that and you get to be so creative. So I love that. But film has its own beauty, like that aspect of being visual and creating pictures and capturing them. And then the editing is so much fun. I love editing. So, yeah, I just like telling stories.
Preach.
So as a director for episodic television, you do then follow through, obviously, the prep, the actual directing, and then you do get to follow through and sit in the edit room and be involved in those choices as well?
Yes, not the same way you are in like the indie world. So as a director in television, I get 4 days. So that's really hard because I'm a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. So typically what happens is the editor does their cut, and that's usually a couple days after you wrap. And then as the director, you get 4 days with the editor to make changes, and then it goes off to the showrunner, studio, network, and then you don't know when it airs. If it's going to be what you locked or not. Fortunately, from the things that I've directed that have aired so far, both AHS and Mayans, they haven't changed dramatically. There might be like a couple of little things, which is cool. They were just my episodes were long, so they lifted stuff. So that was really interesting to see what actually ended up on the editing room floor, like that just got lifted from the story completely. Mm-hmm. But it's a different beast and it's hard for me. So what I've been doing, which I can't always do, is I watch my dailies like a crazy person before my edit days start, and then I try to pull all of my favorite takes so that I can maximize my 4 days. But it's really hard because I'm doing that work kind of in a vacuum, and then I'll get the cut. And typically what happens is, like, you get the cut, like, at 11 p.m. on a Wednesday, and you start editing Thursday morning. Oh. So, like, ideally, I'd love a couple days with the cut so I can be like, this is all the stuff I want to change. So, like, when I'm, like, going through dailies on my own, I might be spending time on stuff that I didn't have to spend time on. So it's hard. It's an experiment in letting go. I'm not so good at that. I'm trying.
And it makes me think about those directors who I think like Carrie Fukunaga.
Yeah.
Who directed every single episode of True Detective. And you do then wonder, did HBO just give him a lot of time? Because like what you're talking about is not only requires a lot of talent, but also time. And so to prep an episode, shoot it, be involved in the edit, watching the dailies, and then all of a sudden be ready for that next episode.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and I don't know how they shot that. I don't know if they were doing block shooting of the whole season or if they did one by one. Like with him directing them all, I don't know how they structured it. For Raising Dion, I did 2 episodes, and so we were block shooting where we took all the scenes from both episodes that happened in the same location and shooting them at once. It's how you would do a feature. I would imagine for like a 10-part, that would be difficult, but maybe that's how they did it, you know? But yeah, trying to keep track of 10 different episodes and like, this is the scene from episode 9, but now we're shooting the scene from episode 2 and this thing, like, yeah. That's nutso. But maybe that's how they did it. But I don't really know. And then I would imagine he probably has an EP credit. So with an EP credit, he's probably not getting 4 days per episode. He probably has legit time.
Right.
I have a question about the block shooting then. So it's interesting to me. I think for any actor, that's probably a little bit more of a challenge to be in one mindset for one episode and then to be completely in a different mindset or space for another episode. How was that in terms of directing a child?
It's hard. It's hard. And our little actor is so talented. He is such a love bug. He's my baby and I miss him so much. But I mean, for me, what I do, like when I'm shot listing, I put like the event, like I have one time, like one document that's just timeline of like every episode, every scene and the events of that scene. And then when I'm organizing my day, I'm in my shot was putting the scene that happened before and the scene after so that I can help remind the actors. Those weren't the biggest challenges with Little Man. Like, I don't think timeline was difficult. It's just focus, you know, he's seven. So keeping Little Man focused, it's tough. And you only get 4 hours with him. So trying to get everything that you need, and continuity is tough because he's seven, but he's so talented and he's such a love. So yeah.
Great.
Speaking of, you referred to how, Carrie Joji Fukunaga would have a little bit more time because he's an EP. Is that something that you also are looking forward to doing? Is becoming an EP, maybe even directing more episodes and being more attached to a series as a showrunner or something like that? Was that a next step or a goal for you?
Yeah, I'm working with Kira Sedgwick's company, Big Swing Productions, on a property called The Authentics. It's a book, and we're developing it together, and it's a very near and dear to my heart, and it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. So we're talking about my potentially co-show running, which is great because I just love this story so, so much, but I'll definitely direct the pilot.
Wow, that's so exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. We're still developing and, you know, knock on wood, hopefully we have interest, but I'm really excited about it. I think for the right show, I'd be interested. It's a big time commitment and it does involve producing, which isn't necessarily my first love, but it's like for this particular property, I want to protect it so deeply. Like I love it so much that it seems logical to be in that position so that I can keep it safe. And, you know, I definitely want to be directing pilots. I wouldn't necessarily say that like EP is the goal, but I want to be directing pilots and I want to be directing like end goal is like big studio feature films, you know, if they still exist, but that's what I'd really love to do.
Of course. Has your experience and now your rise through doing multiple episodes of television, you know, you're getting your name out there on a level you haven't in the past, which is amazing. Has that given you a little bit more opportunity to get in the room with feature film studio executives to be able to get that opportunity?
Absolutely. And I love my reps. They're amazing. And they've been really like strategic in all of that, because I do have like indie features based on my short films, and we've raised like half the money, and then you try to raise the other half and the first half falls out, and it's so frustrating. And I like from the beginning with my reps, I was like, I want to do a feature. Like that's very important to me. And they were like, let's get you the big TV and then that'll open doors and feature for you. And I was like, but what? But it has, actually. It really has, because I'm working at like $6 to $8 million budgets on some of these shows. Like it's big. So yeah, it's definitely making people feel safer. And because I'm getting to play with the toys, they can see what I'm really able to do. Mm-hmm. And they can see that I can handle a massive set with 150 people and, you know, millions of dollars. So it's allowing me to demonstrate that I can do it.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
So in the midst of developing projects and working on projects and living your personal life, I'm wondering if you have any time to enjoy culture created by other people. We always like asking people, you know, what they're listening to, what they're watching. Do you have a chance to do any of that?
Oh, if only. That's what I dream about. I mean, not really, unfortunately. I want to. But what ends up happening is, like, if I have a meeting with a network, I want to be familiar with the shows that they have on the air. And then if I'm meeting with a certain current exec, I need to know what their current stuff is. And if I'm meeting with a development exec, I need to know what pilots they picked up. So a lot of, like, my leisure time is me trying to just prep for meetings. So I get introduced to shows that, like, I might not have known about and I might love, but I probably get to watch one or two episodes. It's rare that I really get to watch everything. And then I'm an avid reader, but I don't have time to read. Like I'm only reading screenplays, like teleplays. Like I'm like, I just want to read a book.
For your own pleasure. Yeah. Aww. It's funny. I think that I mean, I co-host a pop culture podcast, and I've always loved pop culture. And I think I'm aware of most everything on TV and film, but you just realize these days it's impossible to catch up. Like, I'll have meetings, and it's like, oh yeah, let me make sure that I really know what's going on in Bravo. And then all of a sudden I realize I don't know anything that's going on in Bravo. Let's spend the next day binge watching various. So it is, I think, increasingly difficult when there are 500 scripted shows and probably 500 unscripted shows. And yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. It's exactly what you described. You're like, not only like, I didn't know Bravo had all this. Sometimes it's like, wait, Bravo? Like, uh-huh. Of course I've heard of Bravo, but sometimes it's like a channel or like, where did this one come from? Like, I haven't even heard of this
yes.
But I mean, the joy is that like my homework to prep for jobs is like watching TV. Like, oh, poor me. I can't really complain. But
mm-hmm. It's such a broad question, but you're obviously someone who has taken a really interesting route to being where you are and a continued interesting route. So for people listening who are interested in becoming a director or some role in television and film, what advice would you give?
That's a good question. I mean, it's twofold. One is create the work. Don't wait for permission. Like, even if you're shooting it on your iPhone on the weekends with like you and your mom, like it doesn't matter. Just like create the work. That's the most important thing, because you can't get a job if you don't have something to show for it. So, and you don't have to spend a lot of money. Like, you really don't. You just have to show your voice and that you've got something important to say and that you understand how to tell a story. And you can do that with no money. I mean, like, the shorts that I've done that have opened the doors for me that I'm super grateful for have, like, ranged in price from, like, $6,000 to $15,000, which is still a lot of money, you know, but it's not $50,000. So, you know, and you don't even have to spend that much. Like, my earlier films I did for $200. Like, you know, whatever you can do to just get the work made, that's number one. Then number two is you got to get the work out there. So festival submissions, if you can't afford festival submissions, putting it online and trying to create attention that way. And then it's a hustle. Like, this industry is so much who you know. And I came out here and I knew like two people. But it's like you have to build your network. You have to find. And for me, it was like, as a woman of color, like joining every organization that supported that and trying and just even if like that doesn't lead to direct work, it leads to like a sisterhood and a brotherhood that like keeps you going when it's tough, because it's tough always. Mm. And being kind, I think that's really important. You never know. Like, I just spoke at AFI a couple days ago to the women of the Directing Workshop for Women, which is a program that I did that changed my life. And what was really interesting was just sort of realizing as I was talking, like Lauren Ludwig, who runs the program, was like, yeah, your path is so circuitous. And how it's like, you know, you did one thing 4 years ago that led to something 4 years later, that led to something 2 years later, that led to a job that you would never know. And part of that is just gratitude. Part of that is like being kind to people, thanking people. If you truly connect with someone, staying in touch with them, like you just never know how one thing's going to lead to the next, to the next. That's my advice.
That's great advice. I give that advice to people all the time too. It's really about being kind and getting to know people and making those connections. So, and you are living proof.
Thank you.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation, really illuminating. I think for our listeners who are big pop culture fans, they really appreciate when someone's able to come on and really very specifically and passionately talk about and explain what they do. So I've learned a lot. Thank you for sharing all of your experience and your knowledge.
Me too. It was super, super. And I always say when we have these conversations, it's an education, and it is so refreshing to hear your experience and how you navigated through Hollywood over the last few years successfully. As always, we always like to tell our listeners how they can follow your work, social, website, anything that you want to share so people can also follow you.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you just so much for having me on the show. It was awesome talking to you guys. You're both rock stars, so this was super fun. I have a website, rachelgoldbergdirector.com, and through that, it probably has links to like Facebook, Twitter, which I don't know how to use, Instagram, which I don't know how to use. So Facebook I know how to use, but yeah, that's the best way to probably find me.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you again, Rachel. It has been such a pleasure to speak with you.
For me too. Thank you guys so much.
We'll be back with the big sell in just a few moments. But first, let's talk about the Max Fund Drive. If you don't know, now you know. The Max Fund Drive is a pledge drive that happens only once a year, and we are in the middle of it right now. It is running until Friday, March 29th, and it is a way to show your support for the Maximum Fund Podcast Network. And the best way to do that is to become a member. And if you're already a member, it's time to upgrade your membership. All that happens right now until March 29th during this Max Fund Drive.
There are many benefits to becoming a new member, renewing your membership, and or upgrading your membership. Let's talk about the benefit of feelings. You will feel great knowing that your money is going to directly support the podcasts on the network. Think of Maximum Fund as PBS for podcast networks. It's completely listener supported. So the money that you're donating every month goes directly to support podcasts like ours, Inside Pop. It allows us to get new guests. It allows us to produce our show every other week. It allows us to elevate the content. So essentially, it is a really direct, wonderful connection that you're making when you support us. It also helps our feelings. We're talking about your feelings. Let's talk about our feelings. If you've listened to our show, you know that Amita and I are two TV producers. We often work long hours, stressful jobs. We're exhausted by the end of the day. And listen, we're producing Inside Pop as independent podcasters. And knowing that people are, A, taking out the time to listen to our show, but then going that next step and donating their hard-earned moolah to support our show is an amazing feeling, which I know inspires me to continue to make this podcast the best it can be.
I echo that 100%. It inspires me as well. It's humbling and it's also challenging, right? I'm humbled by the fact that there are people who are donating to listen to our podcast and who believe in our content. But it's also challenging because it just makes us want to work harder to bring you really cool conversations, really insightful interviews, and continue to raise the bar of what we're doing on this podcast. You also will feel great. And I will say that from a personal aspect, we are also members of this podcast network. We contribute to the other podcasts that are all on this network. And it makes us feel pretty good too when we listen. I just have to say, I feel like Chris Hemsworth when I listen. I feel smart. I feel funny. I feel like a superhero. And weirdly enough, I feel chiseled from head to toe, Sean.
Will I look like Chris Hemsworth if I renew my membership, Amita Patel?
Yes. Yes, you will.
Ooh, money back guarantee from Amita Patel. Listen, she's so we're two members who are planning to renew our membership. We need 24,998 of you people to join us because there is a goal this year to have 25,000 new and upgrading members. If we reach that goal, it allows Maximum Fund Podcast to continue to expand, to bring on new podcasts, to continue to support all of the current podcasts like ours, Inside Pop, on the network. And so it is a huge goal of just increasing this amazing community that is Maximum Fun. Listen, we've gone to Maximum Fun meetups, and all of the members we've met are from soup to nuts, cool, interesting, quirky, funny people. You know, I think it's pretty cool that the people who support and are members of the network really do mirror all of the diverse voices of the people who are actually on the network.
We're such a family, guys. Be part of the family. Join. So it's really, really easy. You just go to MaximumFund.org/donate and you can choose the level of membership that you want. It is a per month fee. It starts at $5. It goes to $200. And the best part is it's not just a one-way relationship. If you join as a member or upgrade your membership, there are some gifts, guys. We are saving the best for last. There are amazing gifts at every single level. And that's all I'm going to say. You have to wait until our next break to find out what those gifts are. And I will tell you, it is worth the wait.
So listen, if you can't wait, if you need to donate right now, it's MaximumFun.org/donate. And you also get to choose which shows you support. So please, if you're listening to us begging you for money, please don't forget to check a little inside pop box to make sure that one of your favorite podcasts is also receiving your support. Let's get back to the show.
Hey, Sean, you know what time it is?
Time to get ill.
Nah, yo, it's time for the big sell.
Oh, and also to get ill. Yes.
It is our favorite segment of the episode where we share something we're enjoying in pop culture with the other, and they come back the following week and give a rating and review. Last episode, I big sold Sean on Kurongbin, this really cool and interesting band that mostly doesn't even have that many lyrics in their song. It's a lot of instrumental work, and their recent album called Con Todo El Mundo. Sean, what did you think?
Well, let me begin by saying that I was suspicious that you big sold this band to me just to see if I could pronounce their name, because
yes,
you know, sometimes I don't pronounce things correctly. For example, in that interview that we did with Rachel Goldberg that we just heard, when I decided to talk about the director of True Detective, my heart started racing, because it's one thing for me to mispronounce his name when you and I are speaking to each other and then it takes me 10 takes to say it correctly, but to do it in front of an esteemed director of television, oh, that was very, I put myself in a very stressful situation, but guess what? I did it. I pronounced Fukunaga correctly.
You did, but it is always so fun to see you hesitate every single time.
So Kurongbin, I did it, is so suspicions of you and your ulterior motives aside, let's talk about the music.
Yes, please.
I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I think your description is right on. It's surf music is also something that I keep hearing, mm-hmm. Keep reading, because I read a lot about them because I was really into their music. And so I said, oh, let me see what else I can learn about Kurongbin and share with Amita and the listeners. Yeah, I really dig their, eclectic. It's an easy word to use, but I think it's really appropriate. It's super eclectic. Everything that you said, soulful, there's rock to it, but surf music. I mean, you really do mm-hmm. feel like you just need to be on a beach, in a backyard, sitting in an Adirondack chair, at a music festival, hearing them live. Their music just yeah. makes you want to feel the sun on your skin and to have a cold beer in your hand. You know, it's like, it makes me feel like summer. It makes me feel relaxed.
Yes.
And
yes.
Every once in a while you encounter this band that focuses primarily on instrumentals. And for lovers of pop music, that's a kind of a really cool thing to experience, that it's not about the lyrics. It's not really about even so much the vocals, but about this great music these people are creating. And in this case, it's a trio. It's three people.
Yeah, yeah. And like they say that, you know, they're influenced by like Southeast Asian, Middle Eastern sounds from Iran. Like it's just, there's so much influences of all different sounds, which is what I think excited me when I started to listen to them. And the song that I love so much is Maria Tambien. If there's a reason that you might be hesitating on listening to this band that does surf music and soul and funk and doesn't sing, start off with Maria Tambien. That was such a great, I don't know, it's an energy-giving song is the best way for me to describe that.
You know, I have a little information about the song Maria Tambien, Amita Patel.
Oh.
So in my research, I discovered that it was the first song that they wrote for this album. And, quote, like most tracks born after a long, dry spell of writer's block, it's one of their favorites, they say.
I agree. It's one of my favorites, too.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the music is like really kind of chill and mellow. Listen, in many states, marijuana consumption is legal. So if I'm speaking to, so for all those listeners in those states, I say grab a blunt, pop an edible, honestly, and listen to this album, because I think it would, like, it's a really cool vibe. There's also a couple of upbeat songs, which I really loved as well. There's one song that I really enjoyed called Evan Finds the Third Room. And that's, I think, like,
yes.
maybe like, kind of danceable and upbeat. And that's definitely a song that I imagine would just be great to hear them at an outdoor festival and dance like a hippie.
Yes. Yeah, that's such a good track. It's such a good track. They're actually coming to Central Park Summer Stage this year, so we might need to go.
We might need to do that.
Yes, let's do it. Let's dance like hippies. Blunts or no blunts. I'm just saying.
I want to give you my my rating, but what I also want to do is, it really inspired me because I watched a couple of videos as well, and I think you suggested that. I watched their mm-hmm. Tiny Desk concert.
Yes, it's so great, guys. Check out the NPR Tiny Desk concert by Krungbin. It's so great.
We'll put the link to that in our show notes. And one of the things I loved about it is that Laura Lee, one of the members, is the bassist. And mm-hmm. I realized that I have real strong passion for female bassists. So let me give you my rating and review. And then, I just like as a little bonus, since this is a special episode, I just want to give you my countdown of my top four favorite female bass players.
I love this. I love this bonus in the Big Cell. What is your rating?
3.25 stars.
Woo! I love it. I'm really glad you enjoyed that.
Yeah. And I honestly have a feeling that seeing them live would be a 3.75, if not 4-star experience. Like, I really mm-hmm. liked the album a lot, and it's begging to see them live. Like, I just need to see them live.
I know, right? Yeah. I know. It's a different choice for me from things that I've sold you before. And I knew it was a little bit of a risk, but I knew that it would pay off because it just hit me so hard. And I was like, I know he's going to feel the same energy I feel when he listens to it. I'm so glad.
Loved it. So thank you very much, Amita. Great Big Cell. And so now, I would just, inspired by that, I'd like to count down my top four favorite female bass players.
Okay.
All right. So number four is, you can laugh because it's a name that's super hard to pronounce for me, Melissa Alfdemar from Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, love it.
She's a great, I don't think I've ever mentioned Smashing Pumpkins on the show, but I like them a lot. And she was, I think that band was, you know, for a hot minute, I was into them, and they were around in the 90s and early aughts, mm-hmm. maybe. But I thought she was a great bass player. And you listen to their music, and there was this kind of driving, propulsive feeling to the music. And I give her credit for that. So, Melissa, number three is a woman who I'm assuming 95% of you don't know, but I wish you did because she's a phenomenal talent. Her name is Gail Ann Dorsey. And she's a solo artist, but she's probably best known because she is just one of the great bass players playing now and has been for the past couple of decades. So if you're David Bowie and you're touring, and you can probably choose anyone to play bass on your tours and on your albums because everyone wants to work with you, you choose Gail Ann Dorsey. So she toured with David Bowie for years. And played on some of his records. And, maybe I'll put this in the show notes. When he sings Under Pressure, which is one of my absolute favorite songs live, or I should say when he sang Under Pressure live, she would sing the Freddie Mercury part. So she's playing bass. Doom, 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 doo, doo, doom, doom. Doom, 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 doo, doo, doom, doom. And singing Freddie Mercury's part. And is hitting all those notes, but also brings this soulful, warm tone to it. I'm putting this in the show notes. Gail Ann Dorsey. Maybe you should be higher, Gail, but I'm putting you at number three. I want to send you this link, Amita, but I'll share it with all the listeners as well.
I can't wait.
Number two, Tina Weymouth of the Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club.
I had a feeling she'd be on this list.
The Tom Tom Club has been sampled in so many R&B and hip hop songs. And the reason why the Tom Tom Club's music is so catchy and I think just so respected and consumed is because of the bass, right? Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. You know that song. Mariah Carey sampled it in one of her songs. What do you consider fun? Fun. That's it. So she, yes. So she, like her, that offshoot band Tom Cop Club was amazing, but please do not forget her work with the Talking Heads, one of the greatest bands of all time, in my opinion. And again, the Talking Heads has, again, some of the most propulsive, soulful, bass-heavy music in pop, and it's Tina Weymouth doing that. And then again, if you have seen Stop Making Sense, which is one of the greatest concert films of all time, you can see that she's playing bass while running around the stage after David Byrne and doing kind of dancing, synchronized moves, and still like keeping the beat and driving the music forward the entire time. Love Tina Weymouth. At number one, Amita's not surprised.
Nope, I knew this one already.
Michelle Indeghiacello. She is just, she's so many things. I feel like she's an amazing vocalist, an amazing bass player, an amazing composer, an amazing pop musician, an amazing curator of music. She's just does it all. I think she's so essential to music in general. But you know what? She bass is her instrument. She plays an amazing bass and really just creates amazing covers and amazing original songs. And one of my favorite songs of hers is from an early album. She does a cover of the Bill Withers song, Who Is He and What Is He to You? And the bass in that song, is all about the bass. And she just does such a phenomenal job of it. Michelle Indeghiacello, Bow Down. Number one.
You all know, like, her Ventriloquism album made our list last year, yeah. And you all know how much of a fan we are. So I love that list. Thank you for that bonus in our big sell in this special episode. But wait, there's more.
I'm exhausted.
What is your big sell?
I'm exhausted, Amita. But I keep giving because...
Give. Please give us more. What's your big sell?
Well, we're asking our listeners to give, so I figured, you know, we should give too.
For sure. We always. We're such givers.
Until it hurts. Amita and I were, quick backstory, Amita and I were hanging out with some friends a couple of weekends ago, and it was right after Solange's album was released, and there was an interesting conversation. It was slightly drunken, so I think it's not completely coherent in my memory, but there was this interesting reaction about how some people really disliked Solange's album, some people really liked it, some people weren't quite sure, which I'm still not quite sure, but what I did want to do was to read more about this album because I'm like, oh, she's definitely trying stuff, right? Like she definitely kind of set about to do something different. And one of the things that I came upon in my research is that she says that she was inspired / influenced by this artist called Tierra Whack. Do you know Tierra Whack?
I do know Tierra Whack. I love Tierra Whack. Her album was also on the NPR Top 50 Albums of the Year from 2018, and I was pleasantly surprised and obsessed with her immediately. And it's funny that you mention her because when I listened to Solange, first thing I said is Solange doing something like Tierra Whack did.
Yeah, I mean, I had never heard of Tierra Whack. I blame you. And I loved it. So essentially, Tierra Whack has an album that came out last year in 2018 called Whack World, and every song is a minute or less. And I read about it before I listened to it, and I was like, this is not going to be satisfying. What a strange experiment, but I applaud the experiment, right? So I listened to it and loved it, and I've listened to it a number of times over the past week or so. So anyway, I'm down with Tierra Whack. And was really, as I kind of go back and try to be cool and then really get into Whack World, which is an easy thing to do to get into it, I discovered that she has a couple of new songs out. So what I would like to do is to big sell you, hot off the press, some new music by Tierra Whack.
I love it.
So Amita, I'm going to big sell you. She has a few new songs. So I would like to big sell you three new Tierra Whack songs. One is called Gloria, which comes in at 2 minutes and 37 seconds. One is called Wasteland that comes in at 3 minutes and 3 seconds. And one is called Only Child, which comes in at a whopping 3 minutes and 59 seconds.
What is she doing long songs now?
I know. It's like, do I have the patience to sit through 3 minutes of music? I do. I like all of these songs, and I hope you do too. So that
would be
So Tierra Whack, new music from the creator of Whack World, which I wish I could go back in time because Whack World would definitely go on my top 10 albums of 2018.
Yeah. I actually think that there were some albums that I wish I put on my top 10 of 2018 as well, like the Her album. But we digress. Thank you for that, Big Sell. I can't wait to listen to it.
Before we end our episode, we want to take one more opportunity to talk to you about the wonderful, wonderful thing that's happening right now, the Maximum Fun Pledge Drive, in which we ask you for money, but also to support the amazing Maximum Fun Network. Now, this only happens once a year. The next episode of Inside Pop you hear, we will not be asking you for money. We will not be asking you to join. So we really want to take this moment now to tell you about all of the wonderful benefits of becoming a member of the Maximum Fun Network.
There are so many benefits. We laid them out before. It's about a sense of contributing to the podcast directly, because this is a listener-supported network. You get to be a part of our podcast and any other podcast that is on this network. It's a huge, amazing feeling. But the feelings aren't enough. You get stuff. When you give something, you get something. And that's an amazing feeling. Tell them about the gifts, Sean.
Quid pro quo, Clarice. Quid pro quo. That's right. We've got amazing gifts for people at many levels. So if you want to donate $5 a month, we have bonus content. Every single podcast on the Maximum Fun Network has created a super special exclusive episode just for members, including Inside Pop. We have a very special episode that's so good I wanted to air it, but we couldn't. We had to give it to the exclusive members only feed. And you get to hear our episode along with every other episode if you join at the $5 level.
Yes, these bonus episodes are rife with amazing, amazing information, incredible conversations. Sean and I, this is a spoiler. If you join at $5 a month, you get our bonus episode where we discuss our favorite New York centric film and TV shows. Do you want to know which New York-centric TV show changed my life? I could tell you right now, but I can't. I'm not going to. You have to become a $5 member and get that bonus episode to find out.
Ooh, you're teasing them.
I am.
But listen, but wait, there's more. If you want to double that and donate $10 a month, you get to choose a custom-made pin. These are really fun, funky, cool pins that you can put on your lapel, on your knapsack, and you get to choose. Every single podcast has one, Inside Pop included. We've had a sneak preview. Ours looks pretty damn cool. And so you get the bonus content plus the pin with a $10 a month membership donation.
And of course, there's more levels to this. There's always levels. If you donate $20 a month, which is like the cost of like an Uber from your town to another town or from Manhattan to Brooklyn, if you're New Yorkers like us, you get a beautiful 550-piece Maximum Fun puzzle. It's gorgeous. We've also seen a preview of that. And why not get a puzzle? It's the perfect activity to do while listening to a podcast. Podcast puzzles, win-win, just at $20 a month.
And the levels continue. They increase. Listen, for $35 a month, you get all of those things we mentioned, plus this really beautiful glass mug with the Max Fun Rocket logo on it. The levels go up to $200 a month, and if you have the means and the passion to do that, we really appreciate that. So it's very, 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 very easy for you to become a member of the Maximum Fun Network. Just go to MaximumFun.org/donate, and there you will be able to choose your level of membership and decide which shows you want to support. As independent podcasters, Amit and I would really appreciate it if you clicked the Inside Pop box, which then will allow us to continue to create great content for you, to continue reaching out to directors and producers and writers and all the amazing people who create the pop culture you crave and who give us an insight into how all this wonderful TV and film actually gets made.
It's a small act with a great return. If you're a current monthly member, thank you, first of all, for already contributing. Think about increasing your support. If you are new to this, start small and think about increasing. If you feel like you believe in this and you want more gifts, go ahead. There are so many ways, in whatever means you can, in whatever level you can. It's all appreciated. And it's super easy. Go to MaximumFun.org/donate. Select the level that's right for you. You have to give your credit card information and some basic information like your name and address, which is usual. And include the shows that you listen to, like ours. And that's it. You're a member. You have joined this network of people who listen and support our podcasts and the people like us who create these podcasts for you. It's an ongoing contribution. It'll process automatically every single month. And you don't have to do anything. Unless the card expires or you decide to cancel, you could just let it go and you know you are part of Maximum Fun.
So thank you so much for listening to our plea for money and actually just for you to join this wonderful network and to join us and to really become an integral part of our show. And thank you for listening to our entire episode. It was a real pleasure bringing you our interview with Rachel Goldberg and sharing our pop culture recommendations in The Big Sell. So thanks, everyone, for listening. We've got amazing shows coming up in the future. We've got a great spring preview ahead for you. Of course, we're going to be analyzing frame by frame every single glorious moment of Game of Thrones that's coming up so soon. Amita, are you ready?
Swords,
you're not.
Swords,
you're not ready.
It's dragons and swords. Oh my God, I'm starting to cry thinking about it. It's too much. It's too much. Let's just stay on script right now, okay? Tweet us, Instagram. Reach out to us at Pop Insiders. Go to Facebook and obviously go to InsidePopPodcast.com to listen to old episodes and learn more about us.
Oh, yeah, and head over to iTunes and leave us a rating and review. We would appreciate it. It helps us reach other listeners who may not have discovered us yet. You know, algorithms and such.
And as always, you can find us on MaximumFun.org, the wonderful podcast network that we've been talking to you all episode about that fosters amazing podcasts that are filled with comedy and culture.
Did you know that every time someone says MaximumFun.org, an angel gets its wings?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.